This is the No Dogma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan.
I'm joined today by Deb Bigger, user experience designer and researcher and the founder of Boston Human Factors. Thanks for joining me, Deb.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell me a little bit about who you are?
Sure. Again, I'm Deb Bigger, and I'm a Massachusetts-based user experience designer, and I also do UX research. I've been doing it for about 15 years, and I went to graduate school at Bentley University, and I have three children, an au pair from Colombia, and a very large treehouse.
Treehouse is very important to you, isn't it?
Yes, there's three bunk beds in it. I didn't tell you that.
No. So today we're going to talk primarily about UX. And first of all, why is UX important and UX research?
Okay. I think the best way to colorfully explain what UX is and why it's needed is I can explain a story of a project that I was on where there was no UX person. And so with that project, I was brought in through an agency to purely take the idea of four male executives that they had written on their whiteboard, and they wanted me to turn those ideas into wireframes so that their developer down in Texas could quickly prototype them out and get VC backing for what they were doing. So I came in and I just observed what they were wanting to do, and I created the pictures they wanted and got it done in half the time, so in 2 weeks instead of 4 weeks. And with the remaining 2 weeks, I came up with a plan for how we could validate with real people that their idea was actually going to be good or not. And the original plan by these executives is that they wanted to do beta testing with 400 or 500 people on that very first prototype version.
So just off of their wireframes, they were going to go straight to pretty large beta testing for a small company.
Yeah, on a prototype. Yep. It was actually a big company, but okay, I'm not going to name the company.
Nope,
yeah, it was a
fine.
Big company. Yeah. But it was like an offshoot of a big company that was trying to create something new to earn new sources of income for the company. So so they wanted to do pretty expensive beta testing, and I was pretty sure that this product was not going to fly. It wasn't going to be good the way that it had been designed, that it was going to really flop. So I put together a plan of meeting with seven that fit their target demographic and one that did not. So their target demographic was female mothers who were looking online for solutions for what to cook for dinner and recipes and things like that. So I just set up shop in a hotel room in Manchester, New Hampshire, and it was an executive suite, and I invited people in one at a time for 1 hour to spend with me. So I just spent a full day there with them. And the result was one person out of seven understood what the site was intended to do and how to use it and the purpose of the site. And that one person was the person that did not fit their target demographic. It was the male executive that was in the, you know, the people that had designed it were the one that got it, but it was not the person they were trying to reach with it.
Which were the mothers.
Yeah, which was the females. So it was just a huge eye-opening for these guys and myself to have these recordings of, you know, it just really flopping. And so we were able to go back to the drawing board, and then they gave me full rein to design it how I wanted to, or using my skills. So all of UX. So they hired me just to do the interaction design, but UX includes experience design. So the overall feeling people have when they use something, use a product or an application. Information architecture, like all the words and the consistency of terms. And then it also includes validating ideas on users. So once I was given support to practice all of my four skills, we were able to come up with a product after a series of user research. So we did user research every 2 weeks. And then the week in between, I would work closely with the developer to make changes to the prototype. So then after doing this, I think it was 4 times, we had something we felt really solid about. We continued to get funding from the VCs. And then by the time I was done with the project, I should say it was 18 months later, there was over 1 million unique visitors to the site. Nice. It was a live site.
It was a nice engagement, starting off as a month.
And then I know, 18 months later,
So you kind of gave a little bit of an overview of some of the different roles, but if I was to ask you, what is UX, user experience? I, as a developer, sometimes have trouble pinning down what that means.
Sure. Sure. It's the overall design of the experience that a user will have using a system. So it's what can they click on? What do they see? What words will they see on the page? And designing those things so that the experience is ideally pleasant and that people want to use over and over again. So often if people try to design a product without a UX person, it's not as ideal as it could be had they used a UX person.
And when you say UX person, I get the impression from yourself and a few other people I've spoken to that UX is more than just a designer. There are other sort of disciplines within UX.
Yes. So there's the experience design person who does a lot of the UX strategy, thinking of the overall product, the overall experience, setting the tone of it. There's the interaction designer, so thinking about which things are clickable, what happens when you click on this page, where does it go next. There's the IA or the information architect that's really looking at the relationship between the way the information is structured on the page and consistency of terms. And then there's the user researcher. So that's the person that they're the people person that, you know, really knows the user. It's an advocate for the user and often sits with users to see if they're suffering while using the application.
If I'm, let's say, a company that's doing fairly well, you make it sound like there's 4 distinct roles. Will that typically be 4 people, or would 1 or 2 people have all those roles or be able to
ideally,
perform those roles?
Ideally, we talk about a UX unicorn, which is hard to find. So a unicorn...
Oh, we have our dev unicorns too, don't worry.
Oh, you do? Okay, good. So... a unicorn actually in UX is more than the 4 that I just said. It would also be someone that can do visual design, so the graphic design, and can also do some front-end coding.
Some JavaScript, some CSS. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very broad range.
I'm like a half-staffed unicorn. I can do all of that except for I don't make really sexy-looking graphic design, visual design. Other people could do that much better than me. But companies, in my experience, when I've worked at big companies and they have these siloed disciplines within UX, I don't think that the teams work as efficiently as having people that have all of the skills or most of the skills or at least a couple of those skills so that they can quickly jump from different roles and fill the need. Yeah.
So let's say I was a company designing some new website or a mobile app. When do I engage those different roles along the way? Because I presume there should be some sort of an order in which you do some of this.
Yeah. So when I think about the design process, I think of there being 5 phases. So there's like the concept phase where you're coming up with this thing that you want to create. There's the design phase where you're actually designing things. And within that design is like sketching, wireframe, prototyping. The prototyping would be a 3rd one. And then validation's the 4th one where you're validating your ideas on real people. And then implementation is like the final phase. So there's concept, design, prototype, validate, and implement. And so when you do the concept phase, you're going to wear, the UX person needs to wear the user researcher hat, like the person that's really thinking about, actually, and strategy too, thinking about what the product needs to do and then what you want it to do based on interviews with potential target audience. The design phase, you want at least three of the UX disciplines, so experience design, interaction design, and information architecture. And then with the prototype one, you want the interaction designer to actually help code and influence what gets coded. And then with the validation phase, you need a user researcher again. And then implementation, you need pretty much all of them on hand to answer questions so that if development says, you know, your idea is really fancy and snazzy here, but we can't do it all in the time that we have, which is very common. You need people to be on hand to quickly make decisions so that you can still create a good product, you know, in a tight timeline.
What happens if a company says, we can't afford it? You know, we have got our small budget, we've got our product manager, we've got a small dev team, we've got some JavaScript and CSS people, we've no more money.
Yeah. Great question. And I'm thinking of, so the companies that I've heard say that, they're not around anymore.
Yeah. So it costs more in the long run.
Yeah. It's a small cost up front, but you know, the example that I gave a few minutes ago, the company that, had they not let me run some user research, they would have spent a whole lot of money on implementing a product that was going to fail the first day. And probably those four executives would no longer be employed at the company.
I know, but it can be very hard to express that to people who've never, let's say, had the experience of working with a UX person.
Yeah.
So there's obviously sort of almost a cultural challenge in introducing something like UX.
Absolutely. And I think that's when it's nice to start out with someone like me, a consultant that you could just have come in for a day, you know, and you can get a lot of answers out of one day. It could be a day of sketching. It could be a day of sketching with users lined up and doing some paper prototyping usability studies. All in one day, imagine, like, so for under $2,000, you could make sure that your product is, that you feel confident your product's going to succeed.
In development, you sometimes come across the attitude that, you know, if you can't necessarily figure something out for yourself, just copy Google or Yahoo or Netflix. Does that work within UX?
Yes and no. I think it's okay to begin with an experience that you think is great and learn from it and then adapt it for your own experience. But don't copy something just because a big company does it if you don't think it's a good experience. But I think it's a good starting point. It's like what we say, why reinvent the wheel? Somebody else is doing it, like, take that and try to make it even better with your product.
But again, I'm thinking from the perspective of people who aren't necessarily skilled in UX. I presume they would have difficulty. Would you
determining
say
if something's good or not?
Yes. Because, I mean, I think the Google search is good, but that's from the perspective of someone that's been using it for a very long time. I have no problem.
And that's pretty
broad,
though, to say that the Google search is good. Yeah. You need to break it down to say what's good about it. Oh, well, when I type the first three characters, it'll determine, predetermine what I'm trying to say and fill it in for me. So if that part of Google is good, then great. But there's parts of Google that's not great, like getting lost between, are you in Gmail? Are you in Google Docs? And feeling lost in those ways. So just saying in general, let's copy Google is not a good idea.
Fair enough. Another thing that you often come across in companies is a degree of friction between what UX says should be done and what development are willing to do. Have you experienced those kind of things?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I was, in 2000, I was a front-end developer And I was also the person helping to come up with what the product was going to do. And it was a complete conflict of interests because I was very limited in front-end development. And so when someone said, how about we make a calendar widget like this, I'd think about what I could do. I know this is a little bit off topic, but I'd think about what I could do with JavaScript, and I'd realize that I hit a wall, so I'd suggest something else. So I think I've experienced development teams where so UX, we can kind of get into this habit of, if we don't know enough about technology, we can come up with this grand idea of what the application is going to do. And if we don't stay really close with a developer or a couple developers, it's easy for there to be a big disconnect and some strong feelings against each other, you know, an us and a them thing. So what I like to do at companies is to find out who is my lead developer that's going to be implementing what I'm creating and really get to know that person to figure out what's in their wheelhouse, what they're able to do, what they're comfortable doing, and empowering them. So finding out which technology they're most comfortable with or excited about learning, and then helping to work within their abilities to put together the best experience we can make together. It's not like I create something and I throw it over the fence and then you just have to do it and figure it out. It's like, that doesn't work. People do that and it doesn't work well. So again, I get to know the lead developer really well. Sit right with them or Skype or whatever and watch them put together what they can do. And then we massage it together so that we come up with an ideal experience together.
When I was a younger developer, a little less patient, and I remember having a kind of a conflict with some UX designer, it felt like, I felt that he was just being nitpicking, but now I kind of get it that it wasn't so much nitpicking, it was every little inaccuracy takes away from the whole. Is that how you feel too?
Yes, but I encourage all UX people to get to know a developer, the lead developer on the project, and to help share the vision that the UX person has so that they have buy-in from the developer for understanding how all of those micro interactions, those little pieces that you're saying are nitpicking, how all those little interactions will actually affect the end experience. So not just throwing a specification document over the fence and expecting you to implement it and not know what I'm getting at. But that actually wouldn't be as bad as me not throwing something over the fence and just, you know, send you an email every 10 minutes week after week of asking you to change little things. Like, that might be the experience that you had. And that could definitely be seen as nitpicking, right? Because the whole experience was not thought out and designed before Brian started coding. You know, so I developers love working with me because they say, oh, I feel so relieved. Like, you've got it together and I feel like I can just code once. I can just code once, Deb. Like other people, so if they don't have a UX person that's got all their T's crossed and their I's dotted, the developer says there's a lot more pressure on me as an implementer to make these decisions of like what's supposed to happen between this button and that button and this size button and that size button and this page to this page, and does it open in a new target window or is it within the same? And they say it's so relieving to have somebody like you on the team that I can just defer all my questions to you. You're going to answer them, and I know that the whole experience is going to be cohesive and come out all together, right? So if it's done right, it's actually, I find development loves to have a UX person like me on the team. And I'll just say like me because I think it's important to find really quality UX people. I can think of probably five right off, but I wouldn't say that we're easy to find.
I think a lot of the problem that we as developers experience is that we're sort of in a sense where the rubber hits the road. If we're late with delivering something, the whole thing is late. And then if we feel that a UX person or even a product person, it doesn't necessarily matter, is making a change that's going to impact our work, it's going to affect the overall deadline. But we're by far the most visible to management. So when management sees a project late, depending on the size of the company, it's quite often fingers pointed at dev.
Absolutely.
And that's an unfortunate scenario, but that is the scenario a lot of us are in.
Yep, absolutely. And I think that situation is up higher. It goes up higher up the chain, that you have to have the people on the top agreeing. Like, that's why, you know, Steve Jobs was the president of Apple, and he was also the lead UX person. He didn't have the UX team as a separate team. It was very, you know, intermingled with the whole product's vision. And he knew that the experience people have using the products was the product. Like, you can't separate them. So if you've got a higher up team saying, just rush, 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 development, implement, that has to be, we need to solve that up at a higher level than the people that implement. But us down in the implementation level can also, we can be friends and we can support each other with our struggles while also encouraging managers and directors and VPs to understand what we're thinking and what we're recommending that they do, you know, is, okay, let's get through this development cycle. But now let's pause and breathe and do it differently. If we want a different result next time, we've got to do it differently. If we want the same result, which is mediocre or failing, then do it, you know, just do it again. Do it again.
Do you, when you've been part of teams, have the teams been, what is the common approach now, just to use Agile?
No one is doing Agile perfectly, so I call it fragile. Like, everybody's trying to figure it out. It's,
I don't know that there is a perfect Agile. I'm no great fan of it. If you listen to my podcasts, I rag on it whenever I get a chance, actually.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Didn't know that. I prefer lean UX. So I prefer, like I was saying, sitting right with a developer and, sketching ideas on the wall and turning it into a prototype together, and then them coming to watch users suffer using it or be delighted by using it.
But do the iterations or the supposed iterations that often companies don't make use of, is that something that would be helpful?
The iterations, absolutely. So we try to be, with UX design and research, try to be like one or two sprints ahead of development or even the technical spec, but while still involving the lead developer. So that they kind of know what we're thinking. So we're not creating some, you know, fantasy land and getting users to validate it, and then development just can't implement it at all. It's like, you know, the lead developer, if it's done right, should have other people implementing for him or her and have the time to come check in for half an hour here or there to know what's going on.
Actually, that leads me to the next question I was going to ask you. What if dev says it just can't be done? We cannot possibly do what UX thinks is the right way.
That happens all the time. And that's okay. That happens, you know. So what I do instead is say, okay, what can you guys do? And then let's work together. Let's sit together. And let's come up with the best experience. And I try to just push a little bit more. Like, okay, that's a little bit better, you know, like, can you guys really try, like, it's almost like, deal a meal. Like, you know, if you can do this, then we can let this go. If you can't do that, then we really need to do this other feature, that sort of thing.
So it becomes sort of a trade or a bit of a,
yeah,
I'll give you this, you let me take that away.
Yeah. But amicably.
Hopefully amicably. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is something I don't always do in the podcast, but there were a few books that you wanted to discuss.
Sure. Harold and the Purple Crayon is a wonderful book, and I bring it up because, it's related to paper prototyping, usability testing. So Harold is a little boy. He kind of looks like Casper the Ghost. If you're Generation X, you'll know what I'm talking about.
Remember Casper the Friendly Ghost, yes?
Yeah, so Casper the Friendly Ghost, but it's Harold, and Harold has this purple crayon, and in the book he's on a blank page, and he draws himself, and now he exists. And then he goes along, and he wants to build a tree for himself. So he builds a tree, and then he's hungry, and he builds some apples, and then he wants to go on a boat. So he draws a boat, and then he draws water so he can sail away. So when I do paper prototyping usability testing, is we come up with the beginning of idea of what we want to do. This is pretty much like in the beginning UX strategy or concept phase. And then I meet with a user one at a time, and I let them it turns into Harold and the Purple Crayon story, where I'll say, here's what the homepage would have on it. Tell me about what's interesting to you. What do you want to click on? And then I actually let them pretend that they'd click, so click, and now what do you expect to see? And then if it matches what I've already drawn, I put it down. If it doesn't match, I quickly draw, like Harold does with the purple crayon. I draw what they would expect to see, and then I create this kind of choose-your-own-adventure from there. And it's amazing the ideas that come as a result that really influence what the product can do or could do someday in the future or maybe even immediately. So Harold and the Purple Crayon, it's a children's book. And then I learned the best of the best of these tricks from paper prototyping by Carolyn Snyder. Snyder. And that was also through Jared Spool of User Interface Engineering. He was teaching a graduate course at Tufts, and I was an intern for him probably 9 years ago. And he let me come along to see the Tufts graduate course he was teaching on. Part of it was the paper prototyping segment, and it's just really fascinating, and I've been using that on many, many projects since I learned.
Did you want to mention a couple of other books?
Oh, yes. There's my book that's going to be out May 1st. It's a UX playbook, and you'll be able to get it on Amazon. And it describes much of what I've talked about, how to form a UX team, the disciplines of a UX team, the benefits, what happens if you skip having a UX team, how to work nicely with development, how to solidify your team if you're kind of merging a bunch of UX teams together.
Who's the book aimed at primarily?
Two parties. So one is the higher level of VPs that are maybe thinking about forming a UX team, or maybe they're trying to create UX teams from other disciplines like product analysts or product management or business analysts. And then the other party would be newly formed UX teams that are trying to solidify themselves and become recognized within a company.
Any final notes, Deb?
I want to be of service to people out there if they're thinking about, should we try to have UX on this project? Should we start dancing with the UX folks? And you can follow me on Twitter. It's Deb, DEBBIGGAR, like larger but bigger, BIGGAR.
I'll put a link on the blog.
Yeah, great. Or my company site is bostonhumanfactors.com. And feel free to call me up. I go to a lot of different conferences to either speak at them or just hear what's going on, what's the latest in mobile design, and I'm happy to help.
Did you say that you're presenting at a few conferences?
Yes, mid-May there's one at the Microsoft Nerd Center. It's about what is UX, similar to tonight, but with some takeaways of a one-pager takeaway for how to get started. And then you can hear about that on if you follow me on Twitter.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for your time this evening, Deb.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, you'll probably enjoy listening to Brian O'Neill talking about good design in software in podcast number 8.
the storm, telling of moving it. Takes one step, takes your voice saying, I am not hearing if you are not naming it. I am not stopping if you are not changing it. Here are my hands, let's see what they're making. In the morning, in the rise up, there's a bridge from all that's been in the dawning. The vines are pushing through the pavement. We were born of burning hearts. We are tearing off the reins from the ground up. We were building from the clouds above. We're raining from the crowd up. We were raising from the ground up. You hold the spade to turn new soil for the coming grace. You hold the plans, no hands but our hands will lead our children. All that will feed you is a fierce prayer, is a fierce prayer saying, I am not hearing if you are not naming it. I am not stopping if you are not changing it. Here are my hands, let's see what they're making. In the morning, in the rise up, there's a bridge from all that's been with the dawning. The vines are pushing through the pavement. We were born of burning hearts. We are tearing off the reins from the ground up. We were building from the clouds above. We're raining from the crowd up. We were raising.
The opening music was Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was From the Ground Up by Isla Nirio from the album Hollowbone.